Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Friday on the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, the Fan, Brent Gunning alongside myself and Josh, absolutely continuing to elevate on the Oxcord Friday. You know, I love a little Billy Town. Oof, it's good. Good way to start with our next guest. God, vibes are high. It's Charles Davis, NFL and CBS color analyst, calling Patriots Steelers this Sunday. Good morning, Charles.
Good morning. How are you guys doing today?
We're doing well. You know, unless you're a fan of a certain quarterback that got injured last night, it was a good display of football kicking off week two for us. I know you were on Bengals-Steelers last week, which was one of the most chaotic games that I've ever seen. Where does that rank in obscure football games that you've called?
I think that you absolutely nailed it with the word chaotic. I mean, chaotic, frenetic, unforeseen circumstances, or let me rephrase. Yeah, that can happen, but that's not really likely, so let's not even worry about it. What? Our long snapper's hurt and our backup's not very good at it? Oh, man. Yeah, no, it ranks pretty high, that's for sure. It was a heck of a game, and great effort both sides. I mean, which, you know, sounds like, you know, normal cliche stuff, mm-hmm. but it really was for a season opener. And remember, Pittsburgh on defense, 94 plays. And a few of their stars played every play. I think Cam Sutton missed one play. And Micah Fitzpatrick played all of them. Really pretty impressive. But a heck of a win for Pittsburgh. And Cincinnati's still wondering how they lost that game.
I'm still wondering the same. I don't even care about the Bengals, and I'm sitting here going, how did that happen? You know, you look at a big divisional loss like that in week one, and obviously, look, it's a long season. It's even longer now with 17 games. There's room to make this up. But what does losing a divisional game to a team that, you know, I know you can never take anything for granted in the NFL, but I bet you the Bengals are sitting there, and they're not saying we will win this game, but if you're doing the old what's a win, what's a loss, they're looking at that and saying we were in the Super Bowl last year, we should beat this team. Like, what does it do to a team with the expectations that the Bengals have to lose a big divisional game like that in week one?
I think it tests them, and what you brought up is very important, because it tests you in your locker room to where's our maturity. Okay, we know we're going to get everyone's best shot this year because we're the defending AFC champions. And here's one that we had, and we kind of let it off the hook. And here's the crazy part. They didn't play particularly well and still should have won the game, mm-hmm. which probably makes it hurt even more. You know, it's one thing when you just don't play well, you get jumped on, you throw the game film away, and you just go, okay, let's just try again. But in this one, you see all your errors, you see all your mistakes, and you still find a way to tie the ball game with, 2 seconds left, and all you have to do is make an extra point, and you walk away and go, we played horribly, and we found a way to win the ball game. So, yeah, that's something they're going to have to combat, mm-hmm. but I think your point in the beginning is the one that they're going to keep in mind. Long season, chance to make it up. Let's not deal with this loss anymore until we have to. Tiebreakers, things of that, there's things of that nature down the stretch.
What were your initial thoughts on Mitch Trubisky, and is there a world where we see Kenny Pickett soon?
I don't think there's a world that we see Kenny Pickett soon. Mm-hmm. I think there's a world where we might see Kenny Pickett. Mm-hmm. I just don't think it's in the foreseeable future, meaning, hey, in the next 2-3 ball games, here comes Pickett, you know, minus injury. I think that Trubisky, I thought his blood pressure was good throughout the game, meaning I didn't see a guy who had any wild swings. You know what I mean? Like, he was too hyped up, or, you know, he had to bring himself up into the game. I thought I saw a guy who'd been a pro quarterback before, was getting a start again, maybe a little juiced in the beginning with a few missed throws. And I think there were some missed throws throughout the game, but down the stretch, he made some plays for them. You know, his mobility helped out. And just the fact that, hey, I've been in this situation before, I'm capable of doing things well, I think he relied on that confidence to help him out, help him and his team out. So I thought he did a lot of good things. plenty to clean up. I think that they missed some shots, missed some opportunities. It'll be fun to watch this week and see if maybe they hit a few of those. And if they do, then I think his confidence continues to elevate. And I think Pittsburgh would feel good about that. I don't think they want to play Kenny Pickett any earlier than they have to. Although I will say this, I don't know that there was much difference between the two of them in preseason. And the reason that Trubisky won the job was that he has played before. They did have a veteran, and they're just hedging their bets a little bit with the rookie. I don't think that Pickett really got beat out as much as the fact that a veteran was sitting there. I thought Kenny Pickett had a heck of a preseason.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about that is, it all goes back to what team it is. You know, if this is a team that doesn't have Tomlin there and doesn't have the Steelers infrastructure, maybe you do look at the rookie and say, maybe there's a little higher ceiling here and we need the guy who can kind of create more for us or go above and beyond to win us games. But with the Steelers infrastructure that just seems to find a way to always, at the very least, be 500, if not better than that, it just seems like he's kind of the perfect guy for that. And then because we do forget of the pedigree he has, it's possible he finds something there. I just want to kind of compare and contrast what the Steelers have been able to do over this run with Tomlin of constantly being in the mix and being relevant versus what's going on in New England. You look at the game you're going to have this weekend. The Patriots are trying to be that machine without Brady. Even without him, you know, you look at the year way back when Brady blew out his knee and it was Castle and they still get 10, 11 wins. What do you think is different about it in New England? Is it just as simple as Brady's not there now and Belichick's kind of half to reinvent the wheel without that guy? To, you know, I just look at comparing and contrasting the consistency the Steelers have been able to have versus New England kind of hitting this speed wobble ever since Brady left.
I think the thing we probably don't give enough credence to and enough credit is the overall roster of New England during those runs, because they're rewarded.
Loaded.
And we used to talk about it all the time that, yeah, okay, they don't have this receiver, right? And they don't draft, and when they do draft receivers, they don't pan out. Remember how many times did Tom Brady play, and all of a sudden Chris Hogan, you know, Chris Hogan, the lacrosse player, is a great receiver for them. Brady brought him along, and, you know, Wes Welker had been cut, and, you know, all of a sudden he turned out to be good, and Danny Amendola is like 2'8", and all of a sudden he's really good, and, you know, Brady's done a great job with that. Okay, what about the rest of the roster? Ty Law's in the Hall of Fame. Willie McGinnis holds the record for most sacks in the postseason in NFL history to this day. Okay? All right? Vince Wilfork is a guy that we're going to talk about going to the Hall of Fame one day. Think of all the great linebackers they had with Ted Johnson, Teddy Bruschi, Dante Hightower, Gerard Mayo. I mean,
Collins. So many. We could keep going, Charles. So many guys.
We could go on. Listen, we could go on a long time. Remember when they drafted Logan Mankins, the offensive lineman, in the first round? Everybody freaked out. Like, what? Who? Wait, Fresno State? First round? What? Logan Mankins is a guy who we're going to talk about potentially being a Hall of Fame offensive lineman. So loaded rosters all the way through. We never gave them enough credit for that. There's never enough credence in him. It was always, you know, it's always about the quarterback and, you know, how he did this. And he did a phenomenal job. He's the best that's ever played. No one's going to sit here and have that fight with you on it. But they had a big-time roster. They're going through roster rebuild right now. When you look at their roster, you're not going to say that it's horrible, but you're also going to say, hey, what about here? What about this position? What about that? And if no one believes what I'm saying now, go back to prior to the draft this year and pull out a quote from the owner of the team, Mr. Robert Kraft, who discussed how important this year's draft was, that they needed to do a better job in drafting and developing players. When the owner comes out and says that, who has never really talked about that stuff, that's been part of their issue as well. That's something that they're working on too.
So what are realistic expectations for Mac Jones? I feel like I don't really know what his outlook is still in a second-year starter in this league. What do you view him as? Is it like a player that he reminds you of the most? Like, I still feel like he's a puzzle to me.
Yeah, and, you know, it's sad because in an A-list, when I say sad, I'm going low-hanging fruit here because it's the same team, okay? And really, no one should be compared to Tom Brady. But the reason I'm using Mac Jones, Tom Brady is they are similar type quarterbacks. They're going to beat you with their mind and their ability to get rid of the football from the pocket. They're not the guys who are going to break out and do a little, you know, do a little song, a little dance out of the pocket and keep the play alive and find someone free downfield. And, you know, I'm going to break through. I'm going to sprint for 20 when we needed 18 on third down. That's not who they are. They need things to be pretty good around them. They need no chaos. They need it. Calm is the wrong word. They need structure. Structure is good for them. Now, what Tom Brady got better at doing over his career was when structure broke down, he knew how to manipulate the pocket very well with footwork. Slide steps, left, right, up, back, climb it, move, all that, yet still finding ways to get rid of the football. Knew where every outlet was, knew where he could ground it, knew where he had a guy that would come free for him. All those things that Mac Jones is still having to learn and still working on and will continue to work on. He's only in his second year. He has not shown that ability yet that when everything gets really muddy back there, Ailish, that Mac Jones is going to find a way to the car wash and get clean. Okay, that's just not who he is. He's not that same type of an athlete. He's not a horrific athlete, but he's also not going to remind you of, look, Mitch Trubisky is a better athlete than he is. And Mitch Trubisky, again, I'm not trying to damn him with faint praise. Mitch Trubisky, that is part of his game. That's really not part of Mac Jones' game yet. So things have to be good around him. Remember when they were good last year? Remember that winning streak?
Mm-hmm.
Remember how clean things were? Remember they were running the football, getting leads, defense was beating people up, and they had like a 6-7-game winning streak, and boy, he looked good. And then things kind of broke down a little bit. Defense wasn't quite as good. People were in the pocket, in his face, all of that, and all of a sudden it wasn't as good. And they were losing games. I think he won his first 6 on the road, and now I think he's lost his last 4 on the road. That's what Mac Jones has to show. Can he elevate out of that where everything has to go his way, has to be perfect? Because if he can, then we'll know a little bit more about him. Otherwise, we're saying you've got to really build that roster up around him in order to get the best play from him.
And you do, and it's funny. We think about Brady as the Brady we think of now, and, man, that guy who came in for Bledsoe in 2001, a very, very different animal to what we see now. And you're right. You know, it's not to say Mac Jones can't become that. It's just there's a lot of steps between starting that way and becoming the guy who can kind of make things out of, you know, not nothing but less than perfect. For a guy who has his limitations as a quarterback in Mac Jones, to two guys who, I don't know, I suppose they do have limitations, but it doesn't feel like it when I watch them. Other than the fact that Justin Herbert's ribs might be broken. The quarterback play in that game last night, I mean, we could start with Mahomes, the little sidearm throw he had on the touchdown. His escapability was electric last night. I just can't think of two more fun guys to watch go head-to-head in a division for potentially the next 10 years here than these two. It is incredible, the display of quarterback and they're able to put on.
When I watch them play, I think of when I growing up, you know, the way that I did playing sports, when you're playing hoops, you played a game of horse when you played with your buddy, right? Or your mortal enemy or whatever, right? You played horse, right?
Sometimes both.
And trick shots, right? Yeah, sometimes both. Or if you didn't have enough time, you shortened it 3 letters or whatever, right? I would guess that in Canada, right? How many times are you going to hit the post? Who's going to hit the post first, you know, first to 3 or whatever, right? That sort of a deal. Everyone has their different things. If it's a soccer kid, you know, who's going to hit the left post, who's going to hit the right post, all those sorts of things. That's what I think of when I see those two play quarterback. Okay, whatever you throw out there, can you match it or top it? And I thought that last night Herbert got his team off to a quick start, 10-0. Mahomes finally gets going, and he makes a great play out of the pocket and sidearms it in for the touchdown, and off we went. And all night long, okay, I see what you're doing. Match this. Justin Herbert hasn't blinked against Patrick Mahomes since he was a rookie. Hard as it is to believe, Patrick Mahomes is like the old man in that division. He's 28 years old. Okay, they're chasing him down. But that's what I see with those two. And the other part is, here's the underrated part of both of them, their toughness. Mahomes got hurt in the first series of the game last week. Yeah, it's a sprained wrist. People think, oh, not a big deal. Your quarterback, the opposite wrist, the opposite hand, gripping a ball, getting hit on it, moving all that, it can be an issue. He threw 5 touchdowns last week, had a big game again last night, despite the one error he did throw it downfield. Justin Herbert took the shot in the ribs, missed one play, came back, and got hit again the very next play, and wasn't about to come out of the ball game. again, underrated aspect of both of them. That AFC West, we said it before the beginning of the season, your fourth quarterback in the AFC West, you're trying to decide, is it Derek Carr or is it Russell Wilson? Who's the fourth? Because Mahomes and Herbert were going to be ahead of them, however you wanted to rank them. I think the consensus would be Mahomes 1, Herbert 2, because of experience, and Mahomes, you know, getting to the Super Bowl a number of times. But tell me this, guys. You guys watch football. You know football. Does anyone throw the football better or more beautifully than Justin Herbert when he's on?
No.
I mean, it's just gorgeous. And it's not a matter of Mahomes doesn't, because he does. But Justin Herbert, he is a training tape on display every time he plays the game.
His ability to spin it is incredible. And that's the thing that I just keep getting sucked into. And look, like, there are a million great, exciting quarterbacks. Like, we're not that far from Buffalo. There are people pounding the table saying, how can you talk about these guys? And they'll talk about Josh Allen. And he's a completely different animal. But just in terms of the throws he can make, like, you mentioned it there. The fact that he gets banged up in the ribs, he has the play where he tries to roll out and he just has to get rid of it. He could not anymore. And two plays later, he rips a 35-yard throw right on the numbers, right on the seam. That throw was incredible. And it's just, again, I'm not saying Justin Herbert is the best quarterback in the NFL, because like you said, there's so much more that goes into it than just the ability to throw it. But I don't know. Like, I don't think that I can say there's a guy with better tools other than maybe Josh Allen. And to me, that's just a size thing. Like, is he the most talented quarterback in the NFL, or is it too impossible to ask because we haven't mentioned Lamar Jackson? We haven't talked about, I don't think he's there, but a guy like Kyler Murray, who's even different than both of those guys. It's just incredible how many different styles of exciting quarterbacks we have in this league right now.
It is. And I'm old enough that I remember the gnashing of the teeth as Tom Brady began aging and Aaron Rodgers started aging, and we can go right down the line where people were like, God, where are the next quarterbacks coming from? We're losing our guys. I don't think we have that worry anymore, because you pointed it out perfectly. Go to each city and those fans will argue for their person and they will have legitimate arguments. Okay? How do you argue against Josh Allen right now? You don't, okay? Josh Allen is right on track for a big season, MVP season. Team has a chance to possibly get to the Super Bowl. We all know that. And he showed it on opening night. This isn't just conversation anymore, folks. This guy's ascended to that level where we expect him to be phenomenal each and every time out. And by the way, he's going to deliver, okay? He's right there. Mahomes delivers for you. Herbert delivers for you. Okay, Derek Carr has been delivering, and people didn't know it because Raiders weren't very good. Russell Wilson delivered in Seattle. Do I need to keep going? All right, you know what I'm talking about. That's where we are right now with all these quarterbacks. And I'll leave you with this one. I remember a few years ago, Justin Herbert's still in college at Oregon. There's a young guy by the name of Trevor Lawrence, who has a very cute commercial, by the way. No blitz. You said no blitz. I love that. He's now in Jacksonville. He was at Clemson. They were at a summer camp, and they were just throwing one day. And a bunch of people were throwing footballs, and it was like a bad movie. You know, when everyone's on the dance floor and you realize that couple are the best dancers and everybody just gets off the floor and leaves them alone? They kept throwing, and by the time the throwing session was over, there's only two still throwing, and they're throwing next to each other. And it was just gorgeous. Like, you know, you see their ability, their mechanics, the way the ball comes off their hands. And by the way, this is not an insult, and I don't think that Trevor Lawrence would even be upset. It was very clear the best thrower was Justin Herbert. Mm-hmm. That didn't mean that the rest of the guys couldn't throw. It's just Justin Herbert's in a heightened, you know, his ability is just so clear. His next step, get to the playoffs and go head-to-head with those other quarterbacks in the playoffs. Because right now, around the league, a lot of people, and I've talked to them, will tell you, I'm still taking Burrow over Herbert. I'm like, why are you taking Burrow? Well, it's just a little bit of extra with Burrow. But that little bit of extra was his team went to the Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. Herbert has to get to the playoffs. And then when that happens, I don't think that little bit of extra will be there anymore, because Justin Herbert's as tough as any of them.
I think it's because Joe Burrow's cool, and he gets like he's a little so bit of an edge for being cool, right? Like he's the cool kid. So.
He does. And A-list very quickly, when you put it that way, okay, when you just said it, okay, it's because people say Joe Burrow's cool. What do people say about Justin Herbert?
He's laid back, he's chill, he's laid back,
he's West Coast. Mm-hmm. You remember when he was coming out in the draft, you remember what was the biggest knock against him?
No Is charisma. The guys didn't love him.
Right? I don't know if he's a leader. I don't know if he can take control that way. He seems a little bit too, you know, a little passive. And guess what? He's nowhere any of none of those things. That was horrible scouting, to tell you the truth. It was a very lazy thing. Because when you went and delved into it, how about this for Justin Herbert? Older brother, athlete, scholar. Older brother was a 4.0. And I believe he's still in medical school, either in med school or he's in residency or what have you, right? Justin's right behind him. He's chasing the older brother, as younger brothers are wont to do. He wants to be the athlete like the brother. He wants to be the student like the brother. So Herbert comes out with a 4.0. Justin Herbert won the Academic Heisman Award in the United States called the Campbell Trophy. Not to mention he was a candidate for the Heisman Trophy itself. This kid has always been competitive. And has always been chasing something that people didn't know. He just doesn't look the part because he's not the guy that's, you know, spitting out blood and screaming at people all the time.
Different type of leaders.
There can only be one Dan Campbell in the league,
that's
Charles.
That's right.
And thank goodness we have Dan Campbell. I have to tell you, because I think he is authentic, I don't think it's an act. I think that's just really who he is. I really want the Lions to be good so that we get that type of a person who can be a head coach in the NFL instead of everything having to be the same cookie cutter stuff we've seen before. And again, not a criticism, but it's okay to have a colorful, different guy. Please let him be successful, because if Dan Campbell's not successful, the next coaches coming through will not have press conferences threatened to bite off any kneecaps because they'll know that doesn't work.
That's true. Lions are actually favored for the first time in 2 years this weekend, so hopefully they can keep that.
It's just 2 years?
It might be a little bit more.
I thought you would have said favorite for the first time since Barry Sanders retired.
We'll see. Charles, thanks for the time this morning. Always love chatting, and have fun Patriots Steelers this weekend.
Hey, thanks a lot. Enjoy this conversation, guys. You take care of yourselves. Have a great weekend. Talk next week.
Thanks, Charles. Charles Davis, NFL on CBS, color analyst, Patriots Steelers game this weekend. What a guy. Hey, leaves you feeling just so wonderful.
That was lovely. I'm trying to think so quickly. Herbert's brother, that's the only way you can still be like on equal footing in the family if
100%.
Your brother is an NFL stud quarterback.
He's going to be like a doctor.
I was going to say, you know, in the house, it's like Justin's there and he's got his MVP trophy and his fat signing bonus or whatever. And they're like, yeah, but I mean, not a doctor.
That's right.
Not a doctor.
Can you save lives? Yeah. Nope.
Couldn't even save your team in the fourth quarter, let alone somebody's life, Justin.
You couldn't have healed yourself on the field last night if you were a doctor.
Great point. You know who would have got back out there a little bit sooner?
He could have popped his rib back in. He would know. Yeah. Oh, boy.
Yeah, that's how it works, right? Just slide it back in.
That's right. He knows what's
up. That's great. That was awesome.
All right. Time for something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats. Yum, yum, yum. Could we see the next highest paid NHLer? Nathan MacKinnon, a little bit of conversation happening. It's media week in Vegas. He was asked about if he's going to surpass Connor McDavid's $12.5 million contract next year or when it's time. He said, you have to ask Pat. I don't know. I'm hoping we get it done pretty soon. I will tell you that there will be more than one number. Like two numbers in terms of the length of the starting salary. Obviously, he's on a very team-friendly contract right now. Thinking that it's going to be double digits is what he kind of alluded to. He's, I think, has an argument to be the highest paid player, but Connor McDavid has very much secured that role for quite a while.
It is tough to say you deserve more than McDavid. That there's something to that. The other thing that's really tough about this contract, and it affects the Avs and MacKinnon obviously both, is that we expect the cap to go up. You just see all the deals that have been handed out with the long, like you see the deal Kyrou got with the Blues. Mm-hmm. It is clear teams are expecting the cap to take a jump over the next handful of seasons. So if you're Nathan MacKinnon and you want to do the 8-year banger, it seems like that is everything he wants to do, then how do you properly get paid if there's a world where a summer from now, Austin Matthews is ringing the bell at a number higher than that? Now, I don't think Nathan MacKinnon can say, I have to be paid higher than Austin Matthews, but I do think he can say, I'm right there with him. Mm-hmm. Then you just look at all the guys who are in double figures. So here's all the guys in the NHL who make double figures. Eichel, Kopitar, Bobrovsky, Barkov, Taves, Kane, Price, Marner, Doughty, Tavares, Carlson, Matthews, Panarin, McDavid. Outside of McDavid and Matthews, can you make the case?
Better than everybody else.
Everybody there, right?
100%.
So now the other thing about this, I'm very much of two minds. One part of me says, oh, I want you to screw this Avalanche team. I'm sick and tired of all these. This
Enough
Nathan MacKinnon,
of the team friendlies.
Honestly, go get your 13 or whatever it is you deserve. But the other part of me says, how much is this the most direct comparable Austin Matthews is going to have when he goes to do his deal a summer from now? And if that's the case, you sure you don't want to do 9-5, Nate? Yeah. Are you sure? It's going to be interesting. I really hope he rings the bell for a big, big deal, because I think that's what the league needs in terms of star players getting paid. I think that's really important, but I don't think there's a world where he eclipses McDavid. We saw what happened with McDavid. Wasn't the report that it was going to be 13 or 13-5? And then he said, everyone's like, oh, that's too much money. And he goes, oh, okay, let's do 12-5. And they're like, oh, so much better. That's so much more palatable. So I do think it's going to be tough to eclipse that mark. But if he's getting what he's due in an open market, all that stuff, he's right there with McDavid for sure.
Interesting dilemma in terms of how it's going to affect the Leafs and everything always finds a way.
It's the only thing that matters in this world is how does it affect the Leafs.
All right, keeping the money conversation going, Roger Federer, the highest paid tennis player in the world for 17 years in a row. He barely played a game over the last 14 months, yet still banked $90 million in off-court earnings. Announces his pending retirement after one final tournament next week. Ben Lewis is going to join us, Sportsnet tennis writer, co-host of Matchpoint Canada podcast. We're losing two goats in 1 month, but maybe a time for reflection and celebration because of their careers. That's next on the Fan Morning Show with Brent and Ayler, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Happy Friday, everybody. Brent Gunning alongside me this morning. If you missed the previous couple hours, you know you can check out our podcast, wherever you get your podcast, Fan Morning Show. It's Oxcord Friday. Josh continuing to crush it. We're back in the Oxcord. We went a little while without Oxcord Friday. I'm glad we're bringing it back. I'm hoping I get it next week. Got some good tunes for y'all. Brent, we should have given it to you. Sorry.
No, I'll be honest.
Did you decline?
There's nothing I've ever wanted less in my life than the Oxcord. The pressure I feel. Like, I would sooner somebody ask me, like, my deepest, darkest secrets than, like, hey, what are you listening to right
Serious?
Now? It's like, I the pressure I feel. Yeah, like, you know, I was just up at a boys' weekend last weekend.
Right.
Had
shout
a time.
Out Sam McKee.
Yeah, big shout out there. And there was nothing you could have done to get me to, hey, throw Serious? On a playlist. I will not. I cannot do it. The pressure I feel eats at my soul. So I don't want any part of it. That would be a bad host if you said to me, you get the aux cord. I don't want it.
Okay. Good to know. It's just really
touched
spicy on that one. Don't want to bug
there.
You next time about the aux cord. I will never ask again. Ben Lewis, Sportsnet tennis writer and co-host of Matchpoint Canada podcast. Should we be playing the graduation song to Roger Federer's departure?
Yeah, I think that could be appropriate. A little cheesy, but that's fine. I'm all for it. Even though I would say timing wise, Roger Federer's news drop yesterday, I really did not see that coming at all. I must say
that was my first initial thought too. Is just at 9 a.m. snuck it in there on a Thursday. I know obviously he's battled some injury this past 14 months, but you seem as surprised as me, and maybe some insight on like how difficult it must have been to finally come to terms with this.
Yeah, I gather, I guess, over the last handful of months, especially like really working up his rehabilitation from his knee and training and getting back on court and practicing and playing, that he must not have responded as strongly and positively as he had hoped, because I mean, he does have this Laver Cup exhibition event upcoming in a week, but from my understanding before, I think he had planned on hopefully playing a couple events this season and fully ramping up to see if he could play a calendar year in 2023. But obviously the knee did not respond the way he wanted. And I suppose it shouldn't be a shock, because he's 41 years old and he's been on the tour for 24 years, which is just completely astounding.
So what is, when it's like, when it's all said and done, I guess we don't have to say when, it is all said and done for him right now. He has said, that's enough for me. What is his legacy? You know, for somebody like me, it will be impossible for me to think about him without thinking of the other two guys. Mm-hmm. It's him and the battles with Rafa. And of course, that one at Wimbledon that we'll always think of, and Djokovic kind of coming after the two of them, but being right there in the thick of it for so long. For me, it's impossible to separate his legacy without just thinking of this era of men's tennis, with the three of them fighting it out for seemingly every slam. For somebody like you, who's obviously just a touch more plugged in than me, what do you think of for Federer's legacy now that it's all said and done?
Well, I personally think of someone who completely changed the sport of tennis, and in some sense changed the way it was played. I think his stretch after he won his first Grand Slam title, Wimbledon 2003, his stretch there for the next 4 or 5 years is probably the most dominant stretch in the history of tennis. If you look at his calendar seasons that he produced between 2004 to 2008, he was an untouchable force. And, if Rafael Nadal had not come along, and then further to that, if a Novak Djokovic had not come along, it felt like there was absolutely no one there who could stop him. The way he played the game, I think, did revolutionize the sport. He was a complete player, one of the greatest serves of all time, some of the best hands of all time, some of the best volleys. His forehand was unbelievable. And you look at the era he entered into, he left, players like Sampras and Agassi, who were sort of at the tail end of their careers at this time when he was rising up. He made them feel helpless on the court. It was incredible. Like, he's, from watching him and Rafael Nadal and Novak Djokovic have different playing styles, but if you watch Roger Federer in his prime, it's something to behold. Like, you really feel like he's playing a different sport than all of his competitors. So for me, he did revolutionize and change men's tennis. That's part of his legacy. And I think it is fitting in a way, actually, that he's retiring just a couple weeks after Serena Williams retired, because also for me, Federer and Serena Williams, I think those two names are the two most famous names in the history of this sport.
Yeah, I think that's definitely fair to say. I mean, for me, I think Serena will kind of always stand alone, and that's just because of the singularity she had in the women's game, whereas Federer was kind of part of this three-headed monster there. You kind of touched on it a little bit, but for me, Federer feels, in terms of playing style there, I think of Djokovic, and he is this fiery competitor, and he's screaming, and hey, screaming at government officials about the vaccine. He's screaming at officials. He's screaming at himself. I think of Nadal as this incredible, incredible athletic competitor, and of course we'll always think of him with the French, but when I think of Federer, I know that George Russick is bleeding into me here, I just think, oh, he's just so classy. Like, that's the thing I always think of with him, is he just had this kind of regal nature about him. Does it feel the same way to you, or is there another kind of thing you would pull out of him that kind of separates him from those other two?
Certainly, I think that the terms that come up a lot when they're talking about Roger Federer are class and grace. Like, he was a graceful tennis player. He played beautiful, elegant tennis. And from all accounts too, like the classy nature of Federer, it's not an act from everything you hear anybody who's had an encounter with him, met him. He is like that kind, great natured person. I don't know if it's the Swiss culture, the way he behaves, but, all the players absolutely love him. He's so well adored. And I think especially now, it's just like for a lot of this generation that is playing tennis. I mean, just a week ago, we saw 19-year-old Carlos Alcaraz win the U.S. mm-hmm. Open and become world number one. His idol growing up was Roger Federer. And I mean, Roger Federer was playing professional tennis before he was born. That's something pretty special and unbelievable. For Denis Shapovalov as well, Roger Federer was an idol of his. And, you know, I think his one-handed backhand was greatly influenced by Federer. There's so many players on the tour today who watched him, wanted to be like him, wanted to play like him. So in that sense, his impact in the sport is just immeasurable.
One of the most crazy stats about this, when we're reflecting on his career, his lengthy career, is he went 1,526 matches without one retirement. Are we ever going to see a stat like this ever in the game of tennis?
Yeah, I mean, I sent a tweet about that. I was joking because, you know, like, I play some Ontario tennis tournaments. I mean, this is nothing professional. And, you know, club players are retiring from matches every other weekend.
Ben, quickly, we've seen the IG vids. These are pretty high-quality matches.
Yeah, you're not
okay? Don't
YMCA,
undersell it.
Ben.
We've seen it. You're getting that serve dialed. We've seen it, Ben.
Well, that's very, very kind of you. But, over 1,500 matches, I mean, the fact that he's played 1,526 professional matches is staggering. But that something wouldn't come up at any time in one of those matches that told him, I have to stop, I have to pull the plug. And I'm sure he's played through nagging little injuries and stuff like that. But the fact that he's completed every single one of those, that's kind of an Ironman stat, sort of like a Cal Ripken in baseball type of statistic, where, no, I don't think you're going to see something like that again. Another testament to his longevity and greatness, I think, was from 2003 to 2020, he's made a Grand Slam semifinal, at least one Grand Slam semifinal every single year from 2003 to 2020. And, you know, for so many professional players, I think it would be an incredible dream and achievement to make one semifinal of a Grand Slam. You think of doing it 18 consecutive years, making a semifinal of a Slam. And, you know, he made, I think, over 40 of them, like 46 of them or something. Like, that's something ridiculous. That's another stat that just kind of blows my mind, his longevity. He was always towards the end. Even he did have a stretch from 2013 to 2017 where he didn't win Grand Slams. There was concern about his level. Is Federer, you know, sort of towards the end. But if you look at that period of time, he still made a couple Grand Slam finals and he still made a handful of semifinals.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you a wholly unfair question, but that's why I have you on to do this. Okay, so you mentioned Alcaraz. He wins the U.S. Open. He's the number one player in the world. Now, this mm-hmm. is total layman of me, and I realize that Nadal and Djokovic are still out there. But, like, how long until this guy's in the conversation? The thing that has always jumped out to me is, how many slams would Federer have if Nadal and Djokovic didn't exist, or vice mm-hmm. versa for any of them? And, hey, feel free to tell me I'm wrong, and there's another hot prospect that I'm not aware of. But it seems to me like the world is kind of this guy's for the taking in men's tennis over the next, I don't know, 15 years. Like, is it realistic of me to, I suppose it's unfair of me after a guy's won one, to say, well, he's going to go set the record now, but honestly, what's stopping this guy? Because these three guys just traded them for basically two decades, and this guy doesn't seem to have anyone he needs to share with. How far off base am I, Ben?
I don't think you're too far off base. I will say, like, there are a couple other players who I think will rival Carlos Alcaraz, particularly his quarterfinal match against Jannik Sinner. That was the one that went into the night, finished like 2:45 in the morning. Those guys play for about 5 hours. And Jannik Sinner is another one of those phenoms, an Italian player who a lot of people have felt could be a world number one as well. So I wonder if Sinner and Alcaraz could be the two rivals we'll see. But, I mean, it was pretty noteworthy, I think, months ago, earlier in the season. I think it was on the clay back in Madrid. And Carlos Alcaraz, he would beat Nadal and Djokovic in succession and go on and win that title. And nobody had beaten those two in a row since like 2006, something ridiculous. And Nadal said after in that tournament in press, he said he felt like Alcaraz could be, he feels like he's unstoppable, is what he had said. And that's pretty big words from Nadal to admit that. So I think that tells me he's certainly going to be at the top when we have Rafa and Novak leave this sport. It's so difficult to say because, you know, you look at Pete Sampras when he kind of defined his era in the 90s. He finished with 14 slams. And at the time he finished with 14, people thought that was an untouchable record. Then we get Federer to 20. We thought 20 was untouchable. Currently, Nadal at 22, Djokovic at 21, and seemingly they're going to add some more. So who knows how many Alcaraz could win. I do think Jannik Sinner could be the top rival of his, though.
Before they pass the torch to the youngin, he's going to close out his career next week with also playing alongside the other big three and Murray. I think that's kind of a nice fitting way to wrap up that career. What's this tournament going to be like? U.S. Open, Serena vibes multiplied? Is it going to be, you know, the hottest ticket in the world once again?
It's going to be a completely wild weekend, I think. And Boston is hosting it this year, I believe. And it's just like it's a 3-day event. And originally it was Roger Federer alongside like the legendary Rod Laver, who won a bunch of slams way back when in the 60s. They designed this tournament, I think, back in 2017. And it started out as an exhibition event. They have turned it into something where these matches are actually like go on your player card and count as matches. So they get the best players in the world competing. I'm sure there's a lot of prize money for all players, all competitors who are going for the weekend. So everybody gets pretty amped up for it. The only downside, I guess, to the event is it's a Team World versus Team Europe format. And currently, I mean, Europeans are absolutely dominating the sport. It feels a little one-sided in that sense of like, how can Team World keep up with Team Europe? The best Team World player right now would be Taylor Fritz. He's ranked number 12 in the world. You know, the first 11 are all European players. There's a chance we could see Felix Auger-Aliassime or Denis Shapovalov participating for Team World, given they're obviously not European. But that's my only qualm with this event, that it is sometimes one-sided. Team Europe has won every season. But the send-off, I think, for Federer is just going to be absolutely electric. Federer and Nadal teamed up and played doubles at this event a few years ago, and fans went absolutely wild. So there's a chance of that again. We have Djokovic and Murray there. The possibilities are pretty endless for some iconic matches, I think.
Can't wait to tune
in. How about this? How about this for a doubles tandem? Novak Djokovic in the vaccine. How about that, Ben Lewis? We'll leave you on that note.
Oh, boy. Well, we know nothing is changing that department, right? That's a partnership that will not be existing at any point in the future. We've come this far down the road. But I will say probably Djokovic will get some leniency going into 2023. With the opportunity, I would think, to participate in the Australian Open. But just as we wrap, I will note another costly move here, given Djokovic is unvaccinated, is the ATP Finals coming at the end of the year, which is like you've taken the top 8 players from the season. He's done very well at that historically, and currently he will not have the chance to go because he's not racked up enough points to be in the top 8 of the race. So that's something else you would be missing.
Oh, what a bummer.
What a shame. If only there was something that could be done about it. All right, we have to stop talking about this before the text line turns into a blazing inferno of fire. I should not have dragged us here.
Ben, thanks for joining us. There's no way that, regardless of the situation, that Djokovic can steal the spotlight next week. It's going to be Federer City.
Going to try.
Can't wait. We'll catch up with you afterwards, Ben. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Ben Lewis, our Sportsnet tennis writer and co-host of Match Point Canada podcast. And it's nice to have, I honestly think Serena and Federer kind of in that same month, it has some beauty to it, you know, like to
some
have
serendipity.
Some serendipity to have them go out at the same time. Tough for tennis fans, but there is a lot of positivity in some of these young stars coming up, and there's got to be room made for them eventually, so.
Yeah, I don't know what's tougher, that for tennis fans or every time Lewis has to come on with me. And the whole interview is just explain it to me like I'm 5 and here's a shot to Novak Djokovic. That's every time. So he's
should
a
be
great
more
sport.
Literal.
Love him for
with
it.
That shot.
Yeah. Oh, hey, good job by you.
Da-dum, boom.
Good job by you.
If Josh was on the ball, I would have played the drum on that one. He's snoozing. We got to get to that text that we both flagged.
Yes.
That is awesome. So we are in the 6 o'clock hour talking about if you had to burn a curse or blow up a curse item. It's hard to explain how we got there, but we got there. what would it be for the Toronto Maple Leafs? Sean texted in.
This is wild.
It's awesome. I do not feel like there's anything that needs to be blown up. However, a friend of mine owns Bill Barilko's fuselage from his crash plane. I truly believe that the Leafs should put this on display at Scotiabank Arena in order to break the curse. I'm told that he's approached the Leafs about it and they've said no. What do you all think?
First things first.
That's an incredible thing to own.
I don't think there can be a more niche piece of sports memorabilia than the fuselage of a plane that crashed and killed a Leaf. I don't think, like, as far as just super niche items go, mm-hmm. I don't think so. And you know me, Ailish, I'm here for anything. Like, I will do anything it takes to break this curse. If this guy thinks that the problem is, like, I know planes were smaller back in the day, but, like, do you know how big a fuselage of a plane would be? It's going to take up some real estate there in Scotiabank. Yeah, and that's
But it's just
the
piece
there.
Of it, right?
Okay, maybe. You know what?
Oh, no,
you know
it says what? Owns the entire, well, it didn't say a piece. Owns the fuselage.
I figured it out. You see, sometimes before playoff games, this is like a Nashville thing. I feel like see it a lot, or like college football towns. They'll have like the smash car before a game, and they'll paint it in the other team's colors. I don't know what color we're painting it, but maybe that's the move. Is like everybody going into the game or outside in Maple Leaf Square just gets to crack it with a sledgehammer or something like that. I don't know. Maybe that's the move. That was just far too niche a text not to read.
Incredible.
You own Bill Barilko's crash plane fuselage, or you know someone who does?
I'd love a photo.
It's coming
Sean,
on
could you tweet us in a photo of your friend's
great point from Justin
collection.
And Saga. This is the other thing, is the mm-hmm. Bill Barilko curse was broken. Mm-hmm. We all know the song, 50 Mission Cap. Mm-hmm. They didn't win another one until they found his body. Like, we know.
It's insane.
But we're grasping at straws here. Anything and everything we will take to break this curse. Because I don't even know. Do you know how nice it would be if it was, well, it's the curse of X, and mm-hmm. there's something you can do. Mm-hmm. Like the Red Sox, the curse of the Bambino. Okay, mm-hmm. you know the entity you are fighting against. There isn't one. Like, another great one that somebody wrote in, a couple somebody's.
Oh, lots of them.
The Wayne Gretzky stick, blow that up. I have no problem with that. That's a great one. I absolutely love that.
That was the most popular. Greg from Georgetown, Al from Little Britain, Allison from Toronto. Everybody was on the same page with that one. After the break, you know what? Let's switch the narrative and give away some Toronto Maple Leafs tickets.
Ooh.
Stay tuned. That's next on the Fan Morning Show. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.